Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do some ideas, behaviors, fashions, and products catch fire with the public while others sputter and die? Advertising and PR have some effect, of course, but as my guest today will explain, our peers have even more influence on our choices and interests. And the information and attitudes that we spread with the greatest frequency, the ones that go viral, as the expression goes, are the ones that strike us as relevant in multiple ways. Jonah Berger is James G. Campbell, Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Contagious: Why Things Catch On. Jonah, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks so much for having me.
What is a social epidemic?
You know, we see examples of social epidemics all the time. It's a scientific word, essentially, for a trend or something that spreads. So you can think about recently, for example, you go to the grocery store, everybody seems to be buying Greek yogurt. Definitely an epidemic. Or, you know, kale. Where did kale come from? How is it so popular? Or bacon, even. Bacon flavored this, bacon flavored that. Not just in the food domain, though. We see the same thing with movies or videos online or even books. Something that starts small and spreads from person to person, almost like a virus might.
And we don't necessarily do this with the intention of being just like everybody else.
You know, one reason we share things is to be different. And in fact, we often don't want to be the same as everyone else. Yet sometimes in our drive to be different, we end up being the same without even realizing it.
So it turns out that the web is really only part of social transmission, even though we seem to think now that that's where we get all our information.
This is one of the most shocking statistics I came on about while doing this research. You might think that most word of mouth or most social transmission is online, through social media, for example, on blogs, on online reviews. And indeed, hardly a day goes by where we don't see a major news article about something that Facebook or Twitter or now Pinterest is doing. Last year it was Foursquare. Who knows what it'll be next? But actually, when you look at the data, it ends up that only about 7% of word of mouth is online. Not 70, not 17, but 7. A really small portion is online. And if you think about it, that actually makes sense. I mean, think about what you do in the morning when you're having breakfast with your family or having lunch with your colleagues at work or having drinks after work with your friends. Most conversations we have on a daily basis are actually face-to-face, and that's where most word of mouth is as well.
So we tend to think of things that go viral within the culture as just being incredibly lucky. But you've identified that they often have a number of things in common that anybody might be able to apply.
You might think that it is random or it is luck. It's just chance. You know, we see something that gets shared around the office or, you know, goes around our circle of friends or everyone's suddenly talking about a certain story or a certain rumor, a certain piece of news. And you might have thought, well, that's just chance. You know, who could figure out why that is? And indeed, if you look at the web, you know, the two most common examples of why things are highly shared is luck, and then the second is cats. People love to say, oh, you know, people share great cat videos or great cat pictures. That's why things go viral. But actually, in looking at it in over 10 years of research, we found that there's a science behind it. You know, you can't predict perfectly what will be viral. But again and again, we saw the same principles popping up again and again, almost like a recipe or a formula to make things more viral or more contagious.
So ingredient number one, social currency.
Social currency is all about sharing things that make us look good to others. So an example I talk about in the book here is a bar in New York, and you walk inside a hot dog restaurant, you go inside a phone booth inside the hot dog restaurant, you pick up a phone, you dial a phone number, and if you're lucky in their space, the back of this phone booth opens up and you're let into a secret bar. There's no sign on the street. There's no sign inside the bar. You have to have a reservation. It's really hard to get into, but because it makes you look special for knowing about it, people talk about it and share it. And so that happens in all sorts of domains, just like the car we drive or the clothes we wear. The things we say affect how people see us. So we talk about products and ideas and behaviors that make us look good rather than bad.
And the brilliance of that is that once we perceive that sharing some information makes us seem sort of tuned in, we need no additional incentive to spread the word.
Oh, definitely. You know, it's not about, sometimes people think it's about money. We need to pay customers to talk about us, or we need to give them a referral bonus. But take LinkedIn, for example. Many of your listeners may be on LinkedIn or know someone who is. It's a big business social networking site. couple of weeks ago now, maybe even a month, they sent out an email saying to some of their subscribers saying, hey, you're one of the top 5% of profiles or top 1% of profiles on LinkedIn, basically saying, hey, you're a really active user, lots of people are paying attention to your stuff. And thousands of users went ahead and forwarded that information to others. They sent it to their friends because they were so proud that they were one of those special users. In the end, it ended up that actually millions of people were in those buckets. They're pretty big buckets. But the people who shared them felt so special. Oh, wow, I'm an influential user on LinkedIn. I'm an insider. Let me share this with other people because it gives me that social currency. It makes me seem special.
And I thought this was interesting. You know, we think of social media as our ability to sort of keep track of what everyone else is doing. But it turns out that a lot of what we call social media is all about us, what we tweet, what we post, what we put on Instagram and Facebook, that sort of thing.
It's amazing how much social media is about us. Some researchers actually distinguish between informing, so telling others about information, or me-forming, telling others about us. And most social media is actually all about me-forming. You know, you might look at it and go, well, why are you telling me what you did this weekend or what you had for breakfast or, you know, what you're doing for lunch? And part of it is people just love talking about themselves. It's actually, there's some intrinsic motivation behind that. Researchers have done neuro work to look at what goes on in the brain when we share things, and they actually found that the same things that are rewarding with food, for example, or sexual stimuli, actually the same thing, the same rewarding stimuli that drive us to share. We're so motivated by talking about ourselves that that's one reason we can't help but pass me information on.
So we want ourselves to be everyone else's favorite subject, too.
I think we don't even realize it. You know,
yeah.
It's funny. Think about that experience when you're sitting in front of your computer and you're trying to decide what to write or you're on your phone. It's not like a normal conversation where there's a group of people around you and you're interacting with them. Often it's just you and your piece of technology. And so I don't think we think so much about the others there. We think about ourselves because we're the only one in the room. And also some recent research we've done shows that even talking to a larger group of people, so whether it's online or offline, merely broadcasting, talking to a bunch of folks rather than narrowcasting, talking at just one person, actually makes us talk more about self-presentation or things that make us look good because we forget that those other people are there.
Okay, so social currency is one aspect of this. Let's talk about triggers. And these are fascinating because in some ways they turn out to be pretty counterintuitive.
Triggers is a great concept, and as I agree with what you said, one of the less intuitive ones in the book. Do you remember the song Rebecca Black made a couple years ago called Friday?
Oh, sure. She was like the teenage girl, and her parents paid for her to do a video, and yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So 16-year-old girl, she lives in L.A., her parents pay this firm $4,000 to make a song for her. It's a terrible song. It's about, you know, going to school and dealing with those big dilemmas that teenagers have, like whether to sit in the front seat or the back seat of their friend's car. Nobody likes the song. Some have called it the worst song ever, which in itself would be an accomplishment, but it's really bad. So it gets then 300 million views. What gives, right? If people hate this song, what led it to do so well? And we actually went ahead and looked at the data. So we looked at the searches for Rebecca Black over time. And what we found is there were a number of spikes. So searches would spike up, and then they go down again, and then they'd spike up, and then they'd go down again. And when we looked closer at the data, we realized that those spikes weren't random. They were actually 7 days apart. And when we looked closer, we realized that they were on Fridays. So the song Friday is equally bad every day of the week. It's bad on Monday, bad on Tuesday, bad on Wednesday. But Friday rolls around, and there's a reminder in our environment, what scientists would call a trigger, to make people think about and watch and share that song. And so just like peanut butter makes you think of jelly, it's like a little advertisement for jelly, Friday can trigger people to think about that song Friday.
Wow. So even if it's something that we don't think we like, it's top of mind, and so we put it out there.
Top of mind is exactly the way to think about it. Think about the last time you were riding the bus with a friend or, you know, sitting down to dinner and you didn't have anything to say. You're worried you're going to sit there in silence. Nobody wants to sit there in silence. They want to fill that conversational space. They want to have something to say. And so they end up talking about whatever's top of mind, whether it's the most interesting thing or not interesting at all. Think about how often we talk about the weather, for example. Not because it's the most interesting thing we could come up with, but we just want to have something to say rather than sitting there in silence.
You mentioned earlier that in the past, companies have erroneously thought maybe they needed to pay people to really evangelize their products. Talk a little bit about how Buzz, is that how you say it, Buzz Agent works?
Yeah. Buzz Agent was a neat company, and they were nice enough to work with us on some of these ideas. And they have a model where, let's say you're Tabasco, for example. You got a new flavor of Tabasco. You want people to talk about it. So you hire a buzz agent. You pay them some amount of money. And they go out and find people to give your product to and give them a chance to try it. They don't pay those people. They don't require those people to say positive things. They just get that product in front of people. It's almost like a sampling program that you'd see at the grocery store, but a little bit of a nationwide sampling program. And what's great about that is it can help turn people to talk about something that they didn't know about previously. They're not going to talk about a product they hate. And, you know, if they don't like it, they'll tell the people it's terrible. But what's good about it is if you have a good product, something like BuzzAge can help you get the word out. Not necessarily paying people to talk, but it's getting the products in their hands, getting them to try it, and giving them the opportunity to share it if they want to.
And why is it better for to say, like, let's say Tabasco, to give a bottle of the new sauce to someone who might tell friends about it than to set somebody up at a kiosk in the grocery store and give out little cups and little bits of sausage or something?
Oh, no, setting up kiosks is also good, but think about if you don't have a physical product, for example. So let's say you sell a service or you have a website. How do you get people to try it? Or even if you're Tabasco, you know, it's expensive to set up those trial places at supermarkets across the United States. And so having people try it, sending it directly to them, is a great way to give people a chance to try the product. But really what BuzzAge's doing, and we're talking about the book as well, is this idea of turning customers into advocates.
Mm-hmm.
How can you make people that have tried the product, you know, and like the product? We're not going to get people who hate the product to say good things. That would be disingenuous. But if somebody likes it, how can you increase the chance that they tell more people that they like it, that they pass the word on?
Talk about this. You compare the sort of trigger factor of a company like Disney with a company like General Mills that makes Cheerios.
So if you asked your listeners, you know, what gets more word of mouth, would it be Cheerios or Disney World? I think almost everyone would say Disney World. It's a really exciting experience. It's emotional. You go there, you come back, you share the photos of the kids on Space Mountain. Cheerios is really boring. Who would talk about it? You know, you can't imagine anyone sharing word of mouth about Cheerios. But when you look at the data, actually, Cheerios gets more word of mouth than Disney World. It's shocking. You never would have guessed. But when you think about triggers, it makes a lot of sense. Disney is really exciting. It's really engaging when you go. But people don't go very often. There are few triggers in the environment that remind them to think about Disney World. When they come back, it's top of mind, and they talk about it the next week, and then they put that story on the back shelf, and they go on with the rest of their lives. Cheerios is super boring, but we eat breakfast once a day, 365 days a year. It's frequent in the environment. Even if you don't eat Cheerios, you go through the grocery store and you see it on the shelf, and so that frequent trigger makes it top of mind. It's like if you think about Rebecca Black, for example, instead of calling her song Friday, she came out with a song called Leap Day. You know, Leap Day, Leap Day, whatever that song would be, it could still be bad or good, but people wouldn't think about it as frequently because it's not as triggered as much in the environment.
So if we are trying to get something out there to really be very contagious in the environment, we ought to think about something that is triggered by a very common event or experience.
Exactly. Kit Kat did this a couple of years ago with a great campaign. They had Kit Kat and coffee. So Kit Kat was a great candy bar. Many of your listeners probably enjoy it. I know I do. But there were dozens of brands in Hershey's suite of chocolates. The brand sort of got lost. Sales were down. They didn't have enough money to advertise on TV. So they just put a simple radio ad together. Think about having a coffee break, have a Kit Kat. You know what's perfect for a coffee break? A Kit Kat. Pairing those things together. And again, if you think about it, coffee is the perfect trigger for Kit Kat. Sure, it has alliteration. Sure, you can see having the two things together. But more importantly, it's a frequent trigger in the environment. It comes up often. People drink coffee sometimes multiple times a day compared to Disney World, which they only go to once a year. And so the frequency of that trigger helped Kit Kat get back on its feet.
Jonah Berger is with us. He is James G. Campbell, Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the new book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jonah Berger, who is James G. Campbell Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is author of the new book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On. You can be part of the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jonah, another thing that you have identified as a big component of social contagion is emotion, because strong feelings make things memorable to us, but we need to be careful about which strong emotions we inspire.
Definitely. So you might look online, for example, and say, oh yeah, emotions matter. It's all about positive emotions. So if you look at YouTube, for example, most videos there are funny. And so you could say, well, as long as you can make people laugh, people share positive emotion, that's a good thing. Why would anyone share negative emotion? Nobody would share, things that would make others feel down or upset. But then if you look at lots of online news, you in fact see that many of the articles that make online most emailed lists are actually negative in nature. They're anger-inducing articles or anxiety-inducing articles. And so one thing we wondered is, well, are all emotions shared, or might some emotions be shared more than others? And that's why we did a big analysis a couple years ago of a whole bunch of New York Times articles, actually 6 months' worth, to find out which articles made the most emailed list.
And talk about this, because making somebody angry turns out to be a really good way of getting them to share information.
Well, what we found is that anger and let's say amusement or humor might seem like really different things. One is positive, humor is a good thing, and anger is a negative thing, it's a bad thing. How are those two alike? But actually, in addition to the positivity or negativity of emotions, emotions also differ in how activating they are, how fired up you get when you feel them. So if you think about anger, for example, it's negative, but it really does fire us up. When we're angry, we want to throw something at the television or yell at a customer service representative. We want to take some sort of action. When we're laughing, it's actually the same thing, but on the positive side. It's a high arousal, positive emotion. When we're laughing, we're also activated. And what our research found is that any activating emotion, whether it's positive or negative, drives people to share. So whether it's positive, like amusement or excitement, when we're excited, we want to do something, we want to tell someone the good news, or even when we're angry, when we're anxious or angry on the negative side, those are high arousal emotions compared to, for example, sadness. What we found is that anger, anxiety, excitement, humor, all those things activate us and cause us to share. Well, there's other emotions like sadness or contentment. Even though contentment's good, it's deactivating, and so it makes us less likely to share.
Well, it makes sense even if you think about conversations. If you've got a funny story to tell or something's got you fired up, you're much more likely to share that than just, calling a friend to say, I'm feeling okay today. Everything's good, right?
Yeah, and it's really that activating sense that makes us pass on. We even did some follow-up work on this where we were interested, well, hey, does anything that activates us cause us to share? So we brought some students into the lab. We did a really simple experiment. We had them either run in place for 60 seconds, so imagine jogging in place, or just sitting still for 60 seconds. And then we said, okay, great, here's a neutral New York Times article, a piece of online content. Do you want to share it or not? And what we found is that merely running in place doubled the number of people that shared that content. Because running in place is activating. Just like an emotion can activate us, just like anger can activate us or excitement can activate us, even exercise can activate us and cause us to share. And so I think this helps us understand why sometimes we find ourselves oversharing. Have you ever had one of those cases where someone just tells you way too much about their personal life or their kid's digestive tract or something that you never really wanted to know, and you're wondering, why did that person share so much? Part of the reason might be that they're activated, whether they've just come back from a long run or they're shaken by some experience that can cause spillover effects and cause them to share.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking with Jonah Berger about his new book, Contagious. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Kathleen in Fort Worth. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Well, I found this subject quite interesting. I'm just leaving the office myself, and I'm a certified nurse midwife in a group practice, and was wondering how might these concepts be used to motivate and sell a service, such as a healthcare service, such as midwifery care, or this type of thing, where it's not quite as tangible. We do a lot of internet, and I think probably most of our clientele come through either their insurance company or through word of mouth. But I'm always looking for ways to motivate the practice. So
Thanks for your call, Kathleen. What do you think, Jonah? Any ideas come to mind?
You know, we've looked at services as well, and we find that the same things matter. So take emotions, for example. You know, if someone has a really exciting service experience, I had an example happen to me a couple months ago where I had to return a jacket, and I thought it was going to be a terrible experience. The jacket was broken. You know, I thought it was going to be a horrible customer service experience. It ended up being fantastic. They ended up delighting me rather than making me upset, and I told everyone about that experience because I felt that activating emotion. Or a service experience that makes us angry. You know, people often share anger-inducing customer service experiences. So I think it's the same ideas apply to services. Think about, for example, how can you make people look good? Existing customers, how can you make them look good by telling about your service? Or how can you make them seem smart and in the know by talking about the things that you do for your clients? And to really can make people feel like insiders or even just make them feel special, they're going to share with other people because it makes them look good.
Well, let's talk about the public nature of this phenomenon. And some of this came up at the top of the hour, but what is social proof and how does that play into the behaviors that we pick up from people around us?
So social proof is the idea that we use others as a signal of information to figure out what to do. So I think the easiest way to think about it is imagine you're in a city, you don't really know the city that well, and you're trying to figure out where to go to eat. You're going out to dinner, you don't want to talk to the concierge, you're going to go find a place. And how do you do it? Well, we often find a place that's full. We assume that if a lot of people are eating there, it must be really good. And that's this idea of social proof. We use others as a signal of information. Sure, I don't know if the place is good, but I assume if lots of other people there, it must be a good place to eat.
So they know something that we don't know.
They know something that we don't know, and we aggregate those opinions. So you can think of the same thing with the salad fork. I always, you know, whenever I go to a nice restaurant and there's those two forks sitting there, or there's the bread and butter plate on one side, I'm trying to figure out, well, which one is mine? I look to someone else to figure out, well, what are they doing? And I assume that if they're doing it, it's the right thing to do. But that word look is really important. That idea, if we can't see what others are doing, it's really hard to use them as information. It's really hard to imitate them. And so what research shows is that the more visible or public something is, the more likely it is to catch on because people can imitate others. I'll tell you a quick story about Apple here, which I think is a noteworthy story. A number of years ago, they had their laptop. Their laptop was doing well, and they had the logo on top of the laptop to help the user figure out which side is the right way. So you take a laptop out of your bag, you don't know which side has the clip on it, so they use the logo as a compass. Mm-hmm. If that logo is facing you when the laptop is closed, you know that the clip is facing you, you can open up that laptop. But then they realize that if it faces you when the laptop is closed, the logo does, it's actually upside down when it faces everyone else. And so they went ahead and they flipped the logo, making it harder for the user to figure out which side is the right way to turn their laptop, but making it easier for everyone else to see. Because they realize, well, look, if it's built to show, it's built to grow. If people can see what others are doing, they can imitate it. But if they can't see it, it's going to be pretty hard to imitate.
And the same thing worked for the brilliant decision to use white earbuds in the original iPods.
White earbuds was also a great decision. I mean, we all probably remember back of the days of the portable CD player. It's going to yeah. Some old memories. But, you know, remember you had to carry it if you went for a run. You almost had to carry it like a pizza,
right.
Make sure it didn't skip. It was a terrible device, right? It only held 16 songs, one CD. They came out with this new thing called the MP3 player, which seemed really great, but it was also really expensive. And so there was this question in most consumers' minds, you know, is it worth buying this thing? And if I buy it, which company should I buy it from? I've never heard of it. It's a new technology. The problem was that there were so many competing players that all had the same headphones. So you couldn't tell whether someone was using the Microsoft player or the Rio player or something else. But then Apple comes out with white headphones, and suddenly you can see what other people are using. If you notice a lot of people with white headphones at the office or at the gym, now you can use that social proof to make an inference that the product is pretty good. And so if you see lots of people using it, it'll make you infer that it's also worth using and make you more likely to adopt it yourself.
So how does that kind of thinking apply to, say, giveaways that some companies want to use in order to promote their product? Why, for example, is a coffee mug, why does that have more mileage than a cosmetic bag?
I think it's about finding a product that's public when people use it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes people do giveaways, stress balls, for example. Stress balls are great, but what do we tend to do with stress balls? We tend to throw them in our drawer at the office, which is really private, not very public. what's in makeup, for example, can be public if people put it on in public, but if they put it on the restroom, it's a little bit harder to see. So my favorite example of public, one of my favorites, is actually Lululemon. It's a brand of clothing. They make a bunch of yoga clothes and lifestyle clothes, and they give their users a bag to carry home their purchases. No rocket science there, but the one thing they added is it's a reusable bag. They don't give you a disposable bag. They make it reusable, it's out of plastic. It feels sturdy. You feel like you should use it again and again. So you carry your lunch in it. You carry your clothes in it to go to the gym. Suddenly now you're walking around with something that advertises Lululemon. It makes you look good because you're carrying a brand that's well-known and well thought of, but along the way you're acting as social proof for the brand. It's almost like an I voted sticker.
Yeah.
I voted sticker does the same thing. If you see someone walking around with an I voted sticker, it advertises itself. It shows people that someone voted and makes it more likely that other people will vote as well.
Of course, there are sometimes when an effort to put a message out can backfire. And you have in the book the story of these campaigns that were used on television to keep teenagers from using drugs.
So we would think that anti-drug ads would make people less likely to do drugs. That was the whole idea. Nancy Reagan started the Just Say No campaign in the 80s. Very simply, the idea was, you know, your kids, they're kids. They want to, you know, they want to do what's right. But one day, someone at school is going to ask them to try drugs, and they need to be ready to say no.
Right.
So they put together these ads. Very simple, you know, just say no. When the kids ask, just say no. But what's interesting is these ads actually had a perverse effect. Researchers went and they looked at some of the more recent anti-drug ads, and they actually found something really interesting. Anti-drug ads didn't decrease drug use. They actually seemed to increase drug use. Telling people not to use drugs actually made them more likely to use drugs. And the reason is this idea of public. Imagine you're a kid, you're sitting at home, you've never heard of drugs before, and suddenly a TV ad comes on and it says, hey, there's this thing called drugs. The kids at school are going to ask you if you've tried it. They're going to tell you they're using it. They're going to ask you to try it, and you need to be ready to say no. And think about yourself as a kid. You're sitting there going, wow, drugs. I had no idea these things existed. That's interesting,
right.
First of all. Second of all, wow, kids at school are doing it? I had no idea. And even the cool kids are doing it? Who would have thought? I would have had no notion that the cool kids were doing it. Well, now that you're telling me about this thing and that the cool kids are doing it, maybe I should check it out. And so almost implicit in ads or messages that tell people not to do something because other people are doing it, implicit in those messages, well, if other people are doing it, there's actually some value to doing it. So we need to be really careful when we use messages that communicate what others are doing. Public can be a good thing. Making people realize what other people do will lead them to do the same thing, but can lead them to do bad things as well if we're suggesting that other people are doing those bad things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go back to the phone now. We have Tom on the line in Dallas. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Great show. I'm really interested by all this, and I hope to keep learning more about it. My question revolves around brand loyalty and how that plays into the buying experience and how it deals with the consumer's mind.
Jonah?
How branding deals with the consumer
mind? Brand loyalty.
So brand loyalty is a great way to keep people coming back again and again. You know, if they have a good experience and you really like a brand, you don't really look around. You're not thinking about what other brands would help you more. You're saying, well, this brand is great. I'm going to stick with it. And I think to the degree you can get brand loyal consumers, they're great. And also brand loyal consumers tend to be good advocates. Not only do they keep coming back again and again, but because they like that brand so much, they're more likely to tell others. So it's important. I mean, brand loyalty is great. It's also important to make sure, though, that those customers are sharing that loyalty with others. Because if they just love the brand but they don't tell anyone, they're not going to be very useful in helping you grow your business. What you want is people to talk and share about their good experiences. And so, again, it's thinking about how to turn people that like the product or your existing customers into word-of-mouth vehicles to spread the good message to others.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Gary in Plano who asks, how can a small business with a small budget cash in on the public's insatiable attraction to famous people? What did you learn about celebrity endorsements, Jonah?
I think that this is good news, what I'm about to say, for every small business, every entrepreneur. You might think that you have to use a celebrity. You have a little budget. Well, maybe I got to go out there and find that special person to spread my message, because if they're not influential, who's going to listen to them? And so, you know, people end up giving Khloe Kardashian hundreds of thousands of dollars, or her sister Kim even tens of thousands of dollars to tweet about their messages. Everyone thinks that celebrities are the right way to go. What the research actually suggests is that celebrities aren't as important as you might think they are. It's not about finding influential people. It's about understanding the psychology of talk or the science of conversation and getting everyone to share your message. You know, it's almost like, and another researcher talks about it like a forest fire. It's not like the size of a forest fire depends on the size of the initial spark, how influential that initial person is. It really depends on the rest of the forest. If the rest of the forest is ready to catch blaze, then sure enough, it can go up. And so I think it's less about thinking about how can we get somebody famous to talk about our product, and more about how can we get everyone to talk, whether they're, you know, regular everyday Joes and Janes, whether they have 10 friends or 10,000. There's much more people that are normal everyday folks. And so it's more about, again, how can you get people that like your product to tell more people, rather than how can you get someone famous to start talking in the first place.
So all of the excitement and social value is very great, but it turns out the most contagious ideas also need to strike people as having some practical value. Can you talk about how that's defined for your purposes?
The idea of practical value is news you can use, or useful information, whether it's saving you money, saving you time. You can think about newspaper articles that say, you know, here are the top 10 superfoods you should be eating, or here are some secrets to getting your kid into college. And useful information is pretty intuitive, but I think its effects are quite powerful. So I talk about in the book, for example, this guy named Ken Craig. He's 86 years old and made a viral video about corn. You might sit there going, corn? Who cares about corn? A viral video about corn, and let alone an 86-year-old? Who would think an 86-year-old would make a viral video? Not a very remarkable video, not a very emotional video, but it's this guy, Ken, in his kitchen talking about two quick secrets to helping you eat corn better. So if you think about corn, the big problem first is it gets stuck in your teeth, but second, you can't get those annoying little things on the side to get rid of them, those things they call...
Corn silk, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, corn silks. You guys are probably quite familiar with those. So how do you get rid of the silks? Well, Ken's got a secret. Not necessarily the most exciting thing. You chuck it in the microwave for a couple minutes. You cut off the bottom quarter inch. You hold the husk. Clean ears every time. It drops out. All the silks are gone. And so by figuring out useful information and getting people to find out about it, he got them to talk and share because it helps make people's lives better.
Jonah Berger is with us. He is James G. Campbell, Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School and author of the new book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Jonah Berger is with us today. He teaches marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and he has a new book out called Contagious, Why Things Catch On. You can be part of this conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So it's interesting when you talk about practical value, because the reasons that we share things for practical value have intrinsically, you say, almost the opposite motivation of the reason we would share things for social value.
It's interesting because social currency is often about ourselves. It's how we look when we share information. But practical value, at least, seems more about others. It seems more that we have them in mind. You know, my mom, for example, is always sending me articles about, oh, be careful, Trader Joe's peanut butter got recalled. Or, oh, you know, here are some sunscreens that you should be sure to try. They're going to be better for your skin. And so I think the motive, part of the motive that drives that sort of sharing is that notion of altruism. We want to help others. We want to make their lives better. Sure, it helps us look good as well. If we help someone out, we look good in return. But part of it may also be we just want to make others better off, just like we used to help one another by doing things like barn raisings, for example. You know, if you lived in a community, you'd help your neighbors by building something for them, and then they'd help you later on. Sharing useful word of mouth is a little bit similar. It's sharing something to someone that will make them better off, and maybe in the future they'll do the same for you.
What accounts, Jonah, for the proliferation recently of all these like special deal sites, Living Social and Groupon and those flash sales?
Groupon is just amazing. I don't know if you're like me, but sometimes I'm on there and I find myself buying a deal for a type of restaurant I don't even like. It's like 45 minutes from my house, and then I'm going, wait, I don't even like that food, and it's so far away, and I hate driving. Why did I buy this thing? But if you think about it, part of it ends up being because it seems like such an amazing deal. If something is 50 or 60% off, we can't help ourselves. And so one thing I talk about in the book is that psychology of deals. How do deals work? What makes a deal seem better or worse? And part of it is definitely that idea of scarcity. You know, a deal makes it seem like it's not going to be here forever. If you look at a rug shop you might have near your house, if they say, going out of business, well, you assume, wow, if I don't get there soon, the deal's going to be gone. Where if it, every day it just said everyday low prices, JCPenney did that recently, for example, you say, okay, well, every day is low prices, today is low prices, but tomorrow will be too. There's nothing compelling me to go there today in particular.
Yeah, the JCPenney thing has been interesting because their idea was that sales had become devalued, but it turns out people still are drawn to that, even if they're sort of told that the prices are always like sale prices.
And I think, if a retailer always has sales, or every day it's 10% off, and then tomorrow it's 15, and then back 10 again, we start not to believe the retailer. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like if you look at that rug store, for example, if it's always going out of business, and you live in the neighborhood, and it's been going out of business for the last 2 years, you start not really trusting them and trusting the deals. So I think that's what JCPenney had in mind. One thing we talk about in the book, though, is a better way to frame deals. So we talk about this idea of a rule of 100, where you can frame the same deal as percentage off or money off. So take a $20 T-shirt, for example. Well, you can make it 25% off, which would be $15, or you can make it $5 off, which would be $15. Either way, it's the same amount of money, both for the consumer and for the retailer, but research shows that 25% off makes it seem like a better deal. You're just like, wow, it must be really good. I have to get it. But actually, it flips on the opposite side of $100. So if you look at, let's say, a $2,000 laptop, and you think about 25% off or $500 off, there, it's the same price again. It's going to be $1,500 either way you pay for it. But $500 off seems like a better deal than 25% off. And so depending on how you frame that deal as money off or as a percentage off, you can make consumers think it's a better or worse deal.
So it's all about anchoring whatever the price is on to something else.
It's about anchoring. It's about that reference price, but also about how you frame it, whether you frame it in a way that makes it seem really alluring. 500 is bigger than 25, for example. Even though one is percent and one is money, it just physically feels larger to the consumer.
How do stories give us an excuse or, let's say, a motivation to spread ideas?
Stories are amazing. I mean, if you think about it as a consumer or an individual, you're amazed at the number of stories that go around, what happened to a particular person, what happened to a celebrity. We love to tell stories. They're more entertaining and more exciting than just plain information. But when you think about it, stories are actually a lot like Trojan horses. There's something that's hidden inside a narrative. So if you think about that tale of the Trojan horse, that decades-old sort of idea of the Greeks versus the Trojans, and the Greeks hide inside the horse to win the battle. That's sure enough an entertaining story. It's been told for hundreds of years via word of mouth, but it also has a moral hidden inside. It's that moral of beware of Greeks bearing gifts, or that idea of be nice to your enemies, even when they're, particularly when they're being, be wary of your enemies, particularly when they're being nice to you. And actually, most stories have a hidden moral or a piece of information hidden inside. The Boy Who Cried Wolf, for example, is don't lie. That's the moral. Or if you think about other stories, like The Three Little Pigs, it's about working hard and how working hard will pay off in the end. And so really, if you think about it, these stories are themselves Trojan horses. There's an exterior shell, but it carries something inside. You can think about great marketing examples as well. There's a video out from a company called BlendTech. They have this video called Will It Blend? It's all about what happens to, let's say, an iPhone when you stick it in the blender.
Let me say, by the way, I looked this up online after reading the book because I had to see this for myself.
Yeah, and I highly, if you're sitting in front of a computer, I highly recommend checking it out. You can just type, will it blend an iPhone? Imagine throwing an iPhone in a blender and then hitting the smoothie button and say, well, wouldn't the blender break? What would happen? Well, if you look at this blender, it's so powerful. It goes, it starts right up, and it chops the iPhone to shreds. It turns this mass of metal into just, you know, shards of glass and carbon and basically nothing. It takes it to dust. It's a remarkable video. You see this, you have to share it with someone else. It's just so amazing. It's so both emotional and remarkable. But you also realize that it's a Trojan horse for the brand.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to advertise a blender. Blender's a pretty mundane product, not the most exciting thing to talk about. But this video alone has gotten over 10 million views, and the set of Will It Blend videos has gotten over 100 million about blenders, the most mundane product you could imagine, because it's a Trojan horse. Not only is it remarkable, but it hides the brand inside. And so the brand actually went up, sales of BlendTech blenders went up hundreds of percent more than they'd been before after this ad, because it carries the message hidden inside.
And remarkably, it also sort of hides the fact that these are $500 blenders, you know, something that, you know, it costs 10 times what you'd normally spend.
And that is true. So it's not a cheap blender, and not everyone's going to go out there and buy it. But sales did go through the roof after these videos. And if you think about why, it's because people don't really talk about blenders very often.
Right.
The same thing you could think of, you know, well, what am I to do if I sell a mundane product? You know, what if I sell cement or socks or, you know, a service that not many people are interested in? You know, one example I really like a lot also is toilet paper. You could say, well, who would talk about toilet paper? It's super boring. But a couple of months ago, I actually made toilet paper one of the most talked about things at a party at my house. And I did it by putting a roll of toilet paper in the bathroom, but it wasn't a normal roll. It was actually a roll of black toilet paper. And the first time you see colored toilet paper, you have to tell someone else. It's so remarkable and so different, even though it's toilet paper, that it has that inner remarkability. And so it's not just about the product. Is the product remarkable or not? But it's about digging deeper to find what makes that product remarkable.
So, Jonah, how blatantly can marketers or, in some cases, you know, politicians use these things, activists of all kinds, individuals, how blatantly can they apply these ideas? And is there a way to do this without seeming really obvious about it?
I think what this isn't about is it's not about advertising, and it's actually not about trying to sell your product in a very, you know, explicit buy my product, it's fantastic sort of way.
Right.
It's about figuring out who likes your product and turning them into advocates, or allowing people that already like your product, making it easier for them to talk about it, making it easier for them to bring it up in conversation, making it more likely that when they happen to be talking to their colleagues or friends, not making them like the product. If they don't like it, they're not gonna say they do. But if they do like it, it's about encouraging them to bring it up in conversation. By understanding the science of talk and why we talk about some things rather than others, it's allowing them to talk about your product more, spreading word of mouth along the way, and increasing the likelihood that your product catches on.
You write about this really interesting campaign to raise not just funds, but also awareness about prostate cancer.
Yeah, so and you guys may be familiar with this, and I'm not sure if they have it in Texas as well, but it started a few years ago. It's this idea called Movember, and the idea very simply is, hey, we're going to raise money for men's cancers, but we're not going to do it in a normal sort of way. So rather than just asking people for a donation, that's good, but unfortunately it's pretty private. If you think about it, you know, most people don't know what their neighbors donate to or their colleagues at work donate to. It's a pretty private behavior. It's hard to see, so because of that, it's hard to imitate. So they wanted to make it more public, just like the white headphones that Apple had, making its brand more public. And so what they did is they started this campaign called Movember. Basically, instead of sponsoring someone to run a 5K, you sponsor someone to grow a mustache for the month of November. So, you know, they start growing at the beginning of the month. You support them through that cause, and at the end, you donate your money to men's cancers. But interestingly, that's a much more public signal than just donating money. If someone in your office suddenly is growing a big mustache, almost like Raleigh Fingers used to have, you're going to wonder, well, what's going on? And you're going to say to that, you know, that friend of yours or that person in the office, why are you growing a mustache? And along the way, it encourages you to learn about the cause. And if you're a guy, it encourages you to take part in the cause as well. And so because of this, it's grown like wildfire. It's raised hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's now in dozens of countries across the world because they figured out how to make the private public. They figured out a way to add a public signal of that otherwise private behavior, and by making it more visible, help it catch on.
Why are offers for, say, early downloads of a new book or I was going to say CD, but I'm dating myself, an album, why do they have such cachet?
getting an album before everyone else, you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, we thought about this a lot, actually, when releasing the book as well. You know, they have advanced reader's copies, and how do people feel when they get one of these copies? I think if you get something before everyone else, even if it's, you know, a product that you wouldn't think is the most exciting, mm-hmm. it makes you feel pretty special. One example I talk about in the book is the example of the McRib.
Right.
Many of your listeners may be familiar with the McDonald's sandwich, the McRib. It's sort of a rib-like sandwich. It doesn't actually have much rib meat in it. It's more of a constellation of other parts, less desirable parts of the animal.
Through the blend tech and then, yeah.
mixed in with some barbecue sauce. On the outside, it's in the shape of ribs. At least it looks like ribs. And, you know, when McDonald's came out with this, it did okay, but it didn't do great. They were looking for something to help them to actually run out of chicken at the time. McNuggets were so popular, they needed something else to help them defray. You know, everyone wanted McNuggets. They needed another desirable item, so they came out with the McRib. It did okay. It didn't do great, so they needed to figure out some way to help it out. They actually did something quite creative. They actually took it off the market. And then only reintroduced it in the market in some cities some of the time. So sometimes in Indianapolis they'll have the McRib. Sometimes in D.C. they'll have the McRib. Sometimes in Dallas they'll have it. But only parts of the year in certain cities. And what they found is that suddenly people started to care a lot about this sandwich, even though it wasn't that popular before. Suddenly now if it was available, people went crazy. Oh, my God, the McRib is here. We have to go get one. You know, come on, let's go get one before they're all gone. And there actually now is a website called the McRib Locator online that plots all around the country the particular establishments that happen to have it, all because they made people feel like insiders. They took something that everybody could have, just a regular everyday sandwich, and they figured out how to make it desirable by making it more scarce and exclusive. By making it harder to get access to it, they increased its desirability, and it increased its word of mouth.
So, Jonah, lots of people have the sense that what is trendy, what is socially contagious, is moving along in ever faster cycles. Is that true?
I think the web definitely is. You know, things that happen on the web, it's here today, gone tomorrow. There's Gangnam Style a couple months ago. Now it's the Harlem Shake. Who knows what it'll be next month? Always looking for faster and faster memes or pieces of culture to turn on to and to find popular and then to move on to the next thing. But offline, I think we still see the similar speed. You know, offline people are still finding about new restaurants or new services or, you know, new hospice care, new political ideas. Whatever these things may be, and they're not as fast in, fast out. They're more likely to persist and stick around. So while the web definitely has made some of these cycles faster, I don't think it's made everything just to be a flash in the pan.
And it sounds like you also believe that as much as people want to study online communication, we will never have the complete picture unless we also look at the way people talk offline and what they talk about.
Yeah, you know, only 7% of word of mouth is online. 7% is on that, you know, social media, on Facebook or Twitter or blogs. And so we really need to think about offline as well. You know, it may not seem as exciting. It might not seem as deliberate, but that's most of what our conversations are. And those conversations have a huge impact on people's behavior. You know, those conversations that happenstance that you have at lunch about who you're going to vote for, which political ideas you support, or, you know, what service you've used recently, or which tax preparer, you know, we're in tax season. Who do you use for your taxes? What are you doing about your taxes? People are talking about that mostly offline. Doesn't seem like the most exciting topic, but having a good accountant's really helpful at this time of year. And so that practical value may help that product spread.
Jonah Berger is James G. Campbell Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School and author of the new book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On. Jonah, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.